Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Media Roundtable. We're talking to leading podcasters and creators about the shows they create, why they create them, and the impact that they have on the world. So whether you're a listener or a member of the advertising community, you can better understand the content that is out there and feel good about what you consume and what you support. We have a special twist on our format today. We are joined by, later in the episode, we will be joined by Kristen Duenas, who is the Associate Media Director at Oxford Road, which is the ad agency that is really the official sponsor of this podcast. And the reason that we're asking Kristen to join us is because, you know, we want advertisers to be more conscious of what they are getting involved with. And it's really interesting to hear the types of questions that in the buying community sponsors are looking at when trying to decide if something's a fit. So as we get toward the end of the episode, she's going to come on and you're going to get to hear some other voices beyond mine. But first things first, we're joined by a very special guest today. Her name is Amy Westervelt. And she is like the perfect guest for what we're trying to do this season, in that she is a creator both of a network and individual programs that are very, very purpose oriented. She is an award-winning climate print and audio journalist and the founder and executive producer at Critical Frequency Podcast Network. And they've produced more than a dozen different podcasts. She also hosts shows like Drilled, Rigged, which is coming out in October, and Damages, which is coming out in November. So we're going to be able to talk a little bit about that. She also co-hosts the current This Land season 2 on Crooked Media.
Oh, that's not true. I don't co-host that. I'm sorry.
That's a lie. She does not. While we're on the topic of disinformation, actually, this is misinformation because it wasn't volitional. I had no idea I was lying. That makes it miss, right? No, yes. Amy, welcome to the show. What a perfect lead in. Let's go.
Thank you so much. Yeah,
she's a truth warrior. There you go.
Yeah, we did produce the second season of This Land, and I do make a couple of cameos in there because I helped with a lot of the reporting. So,
but yeah. Co-host is just too much credit.
That's true. Yes, that's now. All okay. Rebecca Nagel. She's great. Yeah.
Okay. Can we say you're a supporting cast member or contributor?
I am a supporting cast member. Yes.
Okay.
For
All right. We will take that. Amy, I'm glad that you're with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So listen, we've got about 45 minutes and I've got about 150 questions. And I was telling you before we got started that I'm like the dumbest idiot in the world when it comes to what you specialize in, or a lot of what you specialize in. But I'm trying to catch up very quickly. And this is a really interesting conversation from people, because I think, you know, just in getting to know you and your work better, I feel like I've been able to learn things that I would have never... It wouldn't have come across my path or my routine. It never would have entered in were it not for this program. And I think it's going to be really interesting to a lot of the people that listen as well. So before we get into the work that you're doing with Critical Frequency, can you just give us a little bit of your backstory and your kind of bio before you got into podcast?
Yeah. So I was a print reporter for a long time. I've been reporting on climate off and on for about 20 years now. I'm old. And you know, for a long time I did sort of clean tech reporting and then environmental health reporting. And I worked for The Guardian and The Washington Post and The Wall Street Journal and all these different places. And then maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I was driving around listening to NPR and being like jealous of radio reporters and wishing I could do that too. And so I sent an email to my local NPR station, which was in Reno, Nevada. Subject line, would you like an old intern? And, you know, just to see if I could go in there and learn how to do audio stuff. So they said, yeah, actually, it takes us a lot longer to teach people reporting than to teach people how to use audio equipment. So come on in. And I volunteered there for about a month and then got hired as a reporter. So I did community reporting for public radio in Reno, Nevada. And that's kind of where I caught the podcast bug, because I don't know if you have ever worked in radio or know anyone that has.
10 years prior to this. Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. So yeah. Like, you know, you gather this mountain of tape and then you end up only being able to use, you know, sort of the most straightforward pieces of it to do your little news feature or whatever. And I felt like, oh, all the good stories and characters are cut and then we never do anything with them. So I started making a podcast with a colleague of mine there. And then that, I feel like once you've made one, you know, at least at that time, this is now we're in the period of like 6 or 7 years ago. And at the time, you know, it was a pretty low barrier to entry to kind of take any idea you had for a podcast and make a show.
Yeah, there were only like a few hundred thousand in the iTunes library back then.
I know. Small. And it felt so much smaller than now. So anyway, yeah, then I started making lots of different podcasts and trying different things out and helping friends with their podcasts and all that kind of stuff. So that was sort of the lead up to starting Critical Frequency.
So if you had to define Critical Frequency, like what's the elevator pitch for the network? What's the through line?
I would say, you know, our tagline is the best story is the truth. And I think that kind of encapsulates what we do, which is like very rigorous investigative reporting that we then sort of narrativize. So, so narrative reporting on big issues. A lot of our shows are climate focused, but we do get into a few other kind of areas of life. And we provide that that service to other podcast companies too, which I think is somewhat unusual. I don't know that there are that many other podcast companies that can like provide an investigative reporting team to your show. So, for these kind of real involved narrative reported shows, we've been doing quite a bit of that work.
That's interesting. Now, one of the things that struck me is just kind of how prolific you are in this space, or how much you've been doing. So can you talk a little bit about just how all the things that you're balancing? I mean, I don't know how in the business you are like, are you running the business on top
everything
of being a mom and a
I creator? Do everything.
I don't get how you do that, but maybe you can talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's crazy. I actually was just having a little talk with myself about that this morning, mm-hmm. because I am in the course.
You haven't slept in 10 years.
Right. Like I'm very tired and yeah. I am in the process of, you know, getting set up with like a new ad sales system. And I am totally the problem that's taking so long because I don't have someone else that can like sit in on the onboarding call and like learn how the system works and all that stuff. And so I keep pushing that off because I have, you know, a deadline for something else that that feels more urgent. So yeah, that's definitely that is something that has kind of been a constant thing with us, is just that, you know, I do have you know, producers that we work with, and I have at this point, I now have, let's see, 3 full-time producers working on various shows. And I have, you know, a couple of fact checkers that we use pretty regularly and things like that. But I have a problem ever hiring in the sort of operations realm. I always want to spend any money we have on content. And that's what happens when you're like a journalist that starts a business like this. So
yeah. Well, and you got the founder's dilemma, right? The entrepreneur's dilemma, where it's like, you know, you open a a bakery because you love to bake, and then you find out you know most of the time you don't really get to bake anymore because you're too busy like counting stuff. Anyway,
that's right. That's right. Yes.
So,
yes.
Fun times.
So,
fun times.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I'm sort of like unwilling to give up the baking. So then, you know, it's sleep that ends up getting scrapped.
Yeah. Well, that's a tough one. Well, okay. So, but there's a reason that you're doing all this, and I have a feeling there are easier ways to make a living. What is the kind of central purpose of the work that you do?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to inform people, and I think in the climate space in particular, there has been so much disinformation for so long that I think it's a tougher nut to crack than maybe other subjects. So for me, I feel like, well, if we can tell people what's really going on here in a story form that's accessible, then, you know, maybe more folks will sort of learn that stuff. But yeah, so, I mean, I just feel like, I don't know. I think I've always been a sort of a person who fights for the underdog. And in the climate scenario, we're sort of all underdogs, And so, when I look at this big giant problem and I think about, well, what can I, you know, bring to the table? It's, you know, well, I do have this particular set of skills around investigative journalism. So I feel compelled to put those skills to use, kind of giving people the information that they need to kind of, you know, take action on this issue.
So is there a specific goal that you either have as an individual in this space or as a network or as a movement?
For me, I think it's more like, it really just bugs me when things are incorrect. I was definitely like that kid in school. So I'm kind of like, I've had this conversation with folks before about, you know, am I pushing for a particular policy or a particular, you know, shift in society or whatever. And like, of course I have my own personal beliefs about what I think, you know, would work better. But in terms of the work that I do, I'm 100% okay with someone coming to a very different conclusion than, you know, what I've come to personally, as long as like they have all of the accurate information. So that's like really the piece that I focus on, is just, you know, I think it's really unfair that people have access to different sets of facts. And I think that really only ever benefits powerful people. So I am really focused on just, you know, making information accessible to people in a way that, you know, hopefully they don't have to spend a ton of time or have advanced degrees or go hunting around for it.
So how much of the work that you do is climate specific, and what does it mean when people refer to what you do as environmental journalism?
Yeah, that's a good question. Cause I feel like I've almost gone more and more into like corporate accountability reporting across the board, because that's just where climate has led me, you know? Yeah. Because I think a lot of times people think that if you're doing environmental journalism, that means that you're reporting on maybe climate science or kind of very specific environmental impacts like water quality or air quality. And I do touch on those things, but for me, those are mostly kind of just part of the overall accountability piece.
You're so more in the hold power to account school of journalism.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of, I actually, in a lot of situations, talk about it without even mentioning climate, because I feel like climate has become so polarizing and politicized and all of these things. And it's like, if you kind of have a conversation with someone about about just, you know, sort of fairness and equal access to information, and like those things are a little bit less loaded. Just to give you an example, we did a season of Drilled where I hung out with these crab fishermen for several months and yes. Oh my God. I went on so many crab boats and had so many bouts of seasickness. The reason that I wanted to spend time with them was that they had decided to sue their trade industry group had decided to sue the oil companies over the financial impacts that climate change was having on their industry. And a lot of the people in this group, including some of the named plaintiffs in this lawsuit, actually still to this day don't believe that humans are causing climate change and don't really like buy into a lot of, you know, sort of the verified climate science, but they decided to sue oil companies over climate change. So like, how does that happen? And what I found out was that they had been shown primary documents from internal oil company communications and strategy memos and things like that, that showed that the oil companies had been really sort of planning how they were going to adapt to climate change starting in, you know, the early 80s. It's stuff like, you know, redesigning oil platforms to deal with sea level rise, or getting a patent on an oil tanker that can navigate a melting Arctic, you know? Yeah. And so their take was like, look, it doesn't matter what's causing it. They knew, like, you know, we can argue all day long about whether it's natural causes or human causes. They knew it was going to happen, and they were preparing their business to absorb that change. And they were telling us not to worry about it. So that was like a real big aha moment for me, because I was like, oh, maybe like the whole like, you know, believing in or accepting climate science is like too high of a bar, and we don't actually need people to understand or accept the science. We just need them to know that like this thing is happening, and like it's expensive to adapt to, and someone needs to foot that bill.
So what you're saying is the debate about to what extent humans contribute to the change in climate is actually not as material as we make it, because it's kind of like, can we set that aside and just agree that it's changing and we need to adapt to that? And then
correct.
Okay.
Correct.
That's very interesting. Do you think yes. people have woken up to that? Like, do you think that people that are advocating for the industry are approaching it that way? Or do you think it's still
no.
like, is it still just the kind of pissing match we see on every issue in America?
I think people on either side of the climate issue have woken up to this, which is really interesting. I mean, the industry will sometimes say things like, well, yeah, we all knew that climate change was going to be happening, so you can't like hold us accountable. But the key difference there, in terms, you know, they'll say like, you can't just hold us accountable for not acting. But the key thing is that no one else tried to stop everybody else from acting, you know? So when you go, okay, fine. Say it really is just a natural, you know, naturally occurring phase. What about this whole area where the industry knew it was happening, whether they were, you know, going to admit responsibility for it happening or not? They knew it was happening, and they were taking very material steps towards, you know, updating their infrastructure, rethinking their business model, like all kinds of things, at the same time that they were very strongly discouraging anyone else from taking any kind of action at all. So to me, I'm like, well, that's like a way easier thing for people to wrap their heads around. And it kind of, you know, in the case of these crab fishermen, I was like, wow, this is so interesting, because this, like, this one woman I talked to in particular is, you know, pretty hardcore right-wing Tea Party Republican, and this enabled her to take an action that otherwise would have required that she reject her entire identity.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, wow, like this can actually fit within the tribal identity that she already has. And like, why aren't we just doing more of that? Because I don't need someone to like understand every single, you know, minute detail of what I understand.
For sure. Well, and I love that because, who else is good at this is Matthew Iglesias. Mm-hmm. When he's advocating for, he did his book about a billion Americans, and he's kind of like, let's stop arguing about immigration and like, let's find common ground issues that don't have to make it so political. So I think that's really, really cool approach. And I wish that was like commonplace. Okay. I've got so many things I want to ask you, so little time. Okay. So when you are somebody who's an advocate for an issue and you're a journalist focused mm-hmm. on these issues, do the rules change of like, what is journalistic integrity?
This is a good question. And it's like, it's kind of a thorny one because there's like a few things. Well, there's a few things. So for me, I consider myself to be an advocate for truth, not for any particular policy position. And like, there is no way you can look at the evidence on climate change and not come to the conclusion that something needs to be done to avoid like the worst possible impacts. So I kind of feel like if you don't say that, you're advocating for a position as well. It's just, in my opinion, a bad one. You know, like for me, I'm kind of like, well, look, I have all the receipts on these companies. It would be another type of advocacy for me to just sort of put that out there, but not like tell people what it means, you know? Yeah. And then the other thing is too, that like, the industry actually uses the phrase, you know, advocacy journalists or activists to discredit journalism that makes them look bad. So it's this very sort of fraught, topic because they also, I mean, I don't know how far into the drilled archives you've gotten, but you know, they also were, really like the people who created the idea that if you're not quote unquote balancing your reporting on, you know, the climate crisis with a bunch of stuff about what the oil industry thinks about it, that you're being biased against them. Yeah, they created that. So like, so, you know, it's kind of like, there's this weird thing where there are sort of like agreed upon journalism ethics. And then there are ways that the industry has tried to almost weaponize those ethics to protect itself. And that's not the intention of those ethics, actually.
this is a hard one. And, you know, we could do an episode on this topic, but like I get really stuck in my own mind because it's like, okay, I accept the idea that, you know, just because you have a position featured in your content doesn't mean that you must give an equal opposite position if it's mm-hmm. not really warranted, or else like you're debating gravity and like things that are
right.
Like you could do, right. How far do you want to take that? But at the same mm-hmm. time, it's like you do need to counter program to some extent and at least give a fair representation to, you know, what may be blind spots of the individual that holds that position. It's a really right. hard issue, I think.
Well, I mean, for me too, I'm kind of like, again, you know, thinking of this, crab fisherman example, like you're not going to get anywhere by just, you know, parroting activist talking points, you know,
right.
there's a certain amount of, and like a big part of why I, framed Drilled as a true crime podcast to begin with was to hopefully get people who were just interested in like an interesting story or information that they maybe hadn't heard before, and not like climate activists.
yeah, for sure. So let me ask you a question. What would be the impact of how we deal with climate change if you had consensus, open consensus in both political parties? How different would things be?
Oh, I mean, huge. It would be Totally, totally huge. I think because really what's happened is that as both parties kind of argue for, you know, their particular positions, there's just been no action. And I mean, I don't know. I think it's gotten so far away from doing anything even remotely practical. Like I just, it's wild to me that like, we're basically still debating solutions that were on the table 30 years ago.
Wow. Yeah.
Even with carbon capture, like people act like carbon capture is this like amazing new innovation. That has been around for literally decades. And the fact that we still haven't. Yes, it's a gridlock issue. It's also like, you know, I mean, not to get too far into the weeds, but like to use the example of carbon capture or like algae biofuel is another good example. There are these like preferred solutions of the fossil fuel industry that essentially keep the status quo. So like in the case of algae biofuels, they love that because it doesn't require any kind of re-engineering of the combustion engine or any of the ways that we already use power, right? That's what they want to stop, is like some kind of massive infrastructure change that would make them less relevant. So they are very into algae biofuels and carbon capture because, of course, it's like, oh, this is perfect. We can just capture the emissions. But like that technology, we've not figured out how to scale carbon capture for 30 plus years. And like, maybe that will change and I hope it does, but like, I think it's a little silly to, you know, put all of our eggs in that basket. And that seems to be the only thing that, that both parties can agree on because it's like the only thing that doesn't require any other kind of change.
Let me ask you a question. Do you see anywhere within the movement that is focused on more of a charm offensive to winning people over on the other side?
In the climate movement?
Yes.
Let's see. I think,
like, how do you think it's going from a marketing perspective?
Well, that's a good question. Because actually, I mean, the climate movement has been remarkably bad at marketing for most of its existence. And I actually think the thing that's changed most recently that is becoming more effective in terms of kind of building political power is not trying to convince, you know, climate deniers to get on board or even like moderate conservatives. It's actually to appeal to the left, and to actually like acknowledge, you know, the connection between the civil rights movement and the climate movement and between the gender movement and the climate movement and between, you know, various class struggles. Like the fact that like somehow the climate movement completely lost buy-in from the labor movement is ridiculous because the labor movement spent like its entire first 100 years fighting coal and oil.
Well, one of the things I think I've learned just as we've been doing a lot of work on polarization through this show is like, you know, people are increasingly incentivized to, you know, fire up the base on both sides. And, you know, I understand not pandering to extremes that are, you know, opposed, but like, man, how is anybody ever going to get anything done if everybody just keeps going to their corners? Like, I feel like there needs to be a little more salesmanship in, and I don't mean this just specific to climate, but with all issues of importance, to like actually win over like the middle of the other side, or else no work gets done, is unproductive, you know?
Yeah.
So just strategically, you know, that's been,
well, I would just say to that, on climate, that has been the strategy for climate for the last 30 years and it has not worked. They have been trying to pander to the middle for at least 20 years. And where are we? Nowhere. Yeah. So like, I don't know. I kind of feel like, okay, yes, there's like a real fetishization of compromise in the political sphere that it's like, okay, great. But like, what has that actually gotten us? nothing. Like, I don't think that it's helped. It has. It certainly hasn't helped with polarization. We're more polarized than ever. It certainly hasn't helped move the needle on climate policy at all. If anything, it's moved the needle in a bad direction, where you still have a moderate Democrat in office who's arguing for an all of the above energy strategy that is not going to actually do what needs to be done on climate. I mean, I think that like the reality is that we blew it. We blew 30 years in which moderate solutions would totally have worked. And now we're at a place where things are going to be radical, whether we act or not, as I think we've seen this year. You know, like, what is moderate about having, instead of the average 3 extreme weather events in a year that cost $1 billion or more to address, 23 in 2021 already? That is extreme. So it's sort of like this, we have this very, I think, foolish notion, especially in America, that somehow we get a say in this. That somehow, like, if we can all just kumbaya enough and sit around the table and come up with, you know, an amazing strategy that makes everybody happy, that's going to work. And it's like, yeah, you're going to be doing that as, you know, the floodwaters come in. So I just, it's like, it's not the same as other political issues. And, you know, like, it's not immigration, and it's not healthcare policy, where, like, there is some kind of middle ground that can be reached. It's like, it really is actually an either or scenario. And, like, I really actually think that the language of politics, like, is so not up to the task of dealing with climate.
Yeah. Well, I like what you said earlier. I do think that, you know, the marketing is a real area for improvement.
Oh, huge.
But, you know, the value of recruiting on the other side, I guess we'll see.
Let me talk to you about what the Media Roundtable really is. It's not just a podcast, it's a movement. Negative polarization is making all of us miserable. We've talked about how 80% of Americans now believe that the country is falling apart. And meanwhile, private companies are the most trusted institutions in America, while trust in media has never been lower. And the irony here is that it's these same private companies that actually make news media possible through sponsorship. So the Media Roundtable joins together media and marketers and mobilizes them to promote truth and civility in journalism. We're committed to increasing advertiser support for content that shares our values of clarity, fairness, truth, tolerance, respect, and de-escalation. By the way, you can learn more about this when you read the pledge in full at mediaroundtable.com. So if you're in media or marketing, you can make a powerful difference in helping to bind the wounds of our fractured nation without compromising your business goals or your brand values. Media Roundtable is here to help by providing resources and support for our members every step of the way. We want you to get involved. All you need to do is visit mediaroundtable.com and sign the pledge right now.
I want to invite Kristen Duenas into the conversation, and she's going to just kind of help ask some questions from the standpoint of, you know, what is a marketer? I know we're talking about marketing of the industry, but now we're talking about marketers who might want to get involved in supporting some of the work that you're doing, particularly on this issue. But before I open it up to Kristen, I just want you to tell both of us a little bit about Rigged, because I think it's so important in everything that we're working on and talking about. And then we'll ask some questions as a media buying group.
Yes. Well, so like the whole, actually to your point about like sort of doing a better job of reaching people who are not kind of already in it one corner or another. I've spent a long time sort of gathering stuff on how how propaganda works in the US and how disinformation works and the history of that and sort of why these techniques were created and who they've served and all of that sort of stuff. And I used quite a bit of that stuff in a season of Drilled, but I was just thinking that, like, look, there's a ton of people who just by virtue of like seeing the word climate will not, you know, choose to listen to that. Yeah. Even if they actually are, you know, totally in support of climate policy or whatever, I think there's like a sense of, oh, this is going to be depressing or boring or serious or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
And so and I also think there's been a real kind of misunderstanding of how this stuff works. Like there's this very pervasive story out there that, you know, oh, the tobacco companies figured this all out and then everybody else copied them, which is ahistorical and not actually what happened. So I felt like, oh, this is like an interesting issue, is very relevant to everything happening in the country today. And there's a way to talk about it that is somewhat apolitical. And again, just sort of focuses on, look, there's like a power imbalance here. And people have different access to information because of how this whole system works. And that to me seems a little more accessible to a wider group of people. So that was kind of the thinking behind Rigged. And also just the fact that I had like thousands of documents sitting on my desktop doing no one any good. I was like, oh, I started actually just creating an archive online that would be searchable for people. And then I was like, oh, maybe I could do a separate podcast that, you know, takes this, you know, like you can certainly see the connection between this stuff and climate, but sort of takes it out of that realm and puts it into a sort of a broader kind of area for people.
I'm so curious. Hi, it's Kristen.
Hi, Kristen.
How's it going? So I've been listening to you and Dan, and it's so fascinating to me just in general, because, you know, I look at what Dan said about everybody's kind of like in their corners and everything is so far left and right. And, you know, we've been trying to pander to the middle as far as climate change, and that hasn't worked. Mm-hmm. So with Rigged, you know, you're talking about the history and functionality of disinformation and how we got to this point.
Yeah.
But with this, you know, who are you trying to reach? Are you trying to get the people in the middle?
Yeah, actually, I would love for people in the middle or even on the right. Like, I mm-hmm. actually think there's a huge appetite for conspiracy theories on the mm-hmm. right. And I'm kind of like, I look at it and I'm like, well, I mean, there are conspiracies, just not the ones you think, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm kind of like, okay, well, let's, you know, let's show people actually like how they have been manipulated to, you know, to maybe think a certain way, and how mm-hmm. even really innocuous things like, you know, what we talk about as like the American breakfast came about, you know,
right.
So that people understand that, like, yes, lots of people have agendas in this country and like have a reason for wanting you to believe a certain way or purchase a certain way or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to be very careful to not encourage people to like even more towards conspiracy thinking or towards, you know, only listening to like this one random person that they love on YouTube or whatever. And more towards thinking mm-hmm. about like, look, you know, there are actually specific techniques that are very recognizable once you know what they are. And if you know kind of what to look for, then you can sort of clean up your information diet without, you know, having to go to extremes. So yeah, I think like really it's sort of, because I hear from people all the time on all sides of the political spectrum that they just don't know like how to separate disinformation from
right.
information. And like, there's just no media literacy out there. There's like, it's just sort of a polluted information system that people don't really know how to like find their way through. So I'm trying to be very like apolitical very much just sort of focused on, you know, showing people like, okay, here's a disinformation technique and here's how it was used and here's how it shows up in today's world.
And how are you going about getting that audience, right? So this is a little bit different, I think, than the audiences you have for like Drilled or Hot Take, where it's like with Drilled, you have people who already realize and recognize that there is an issue and they're hoping to educate themselves more on what's going on in this world. Whereas with Rigged, I think you're going after something a little bit different and new and a little bit more nuanced. So how are you cross promoting and getting those listeners to find you?
Yes. Yeah. So we are partnering with sort of a broader range of kind of more like news and political outlets. So we're working with The Guardian on some stuff to get Rigged related things into sections of their paper and website that are not specifically climate focused. And then, you know, talking to shows like Radiolab and the NPR politics podcast and like Malcolm Gladwell's show, where it's like more of a sort of general interest history and like how do things work kind of approach than just going to, you know, environment and climate podcasts, which is kind of what we've done with Drilled stuff in the past. And I do have to say that like of all the Drilled seasons that like drew an audience that was sort of like outside the choir, I guess. The one we did on propaganda was like the by far had the farthest.
Herb Schmertz.
The Schmertzster. Yes.
Can you give us a Herb Schmertz anecdote real quick?
Oh God, he's so fascinating to me. He was the VP of public affairs for Mobil Oil for decades, and he you know, really came up with all kinds of interesting techniques to try to get the media to do what he wanted to. But speaking of false equivalents, like he would regularly call up journalists and editors and really like bully them if they didn't present Mobil's point of view in stories about the industry. And the most famous example of that was the Wall Street Journal. He thought they were being too critical of Mobil, and so he demanded a meeting with their editorial staff, where he went sort of like point by point of what he was disappointed in, and their editor at the time said, like, cut him off and said, "Everything you're saying right now is bullshit," and stormed out. And in retaliation, Herb pulled all their advertising from the journal, but also refused to send any Wall Street Journal journalists press releases or annual reports or earnings reports or anything like that for like years. He was a character.
That's awesome. So just a quick question that I had, because I was thinking about like what you were saying earlier about like journalistic integrity. And obviously with podcasts, they do cost money to produce and distribute and everything else that goes along with it. A lot of podcasts, most of them now, are ad supported. You know, you have had ads in your podcast previously. How do you balance the integrity of ads with what you're doing and like kind of the focus of the podcast that you produce?
Yeah, it's been an ongoing and sort of evolving thing, not even just with our ad strategy, but also with our revenue strategy across the board. Because like, guess what? Grant funders also have agendas. So for us, like what I've done is really just work really hard to balance our revenue streams so that there's no one, you know, entity or kind of batch of things is solely like we're not dependent on any one particular thing. So right now we have probably about 10 to 15% from ad revenue, or at least like talking about 2020, because we did have this thing where, you know, we're shifting ad sales. And so we had a little bit of like a drought for a few months there, but like 10 to 15% ad sales, 25% grant funding, 25% production services for other podcast companies. And then the rest crowdfunding. We actually have like a fairly good amount of revenue coming from newsletter and Patreon stuff too. So I like that, because I'm like, we're about equally beholden to readers and listeners as we are to advertisers and grant funders and, you know, and everything else. So, and I mean, you know, I had the experience in early 2020 where a grant funder was being really aggressive about pushing their agenda, and I sent their check back, and that like created a sudden and very like stressful lack of funding that I had to like, you know, scramble to fix. And I, so, you know, really I was like, okay, I don't want to be in that situation again. So yeah, now we're in a place where it's sort of like pretty evenly split between those buckets. And that just, it gives us a ton of flexibility, but also it really enables us to have a level of integrity that I think we need to have to do the kind of work that we do.
And then with ads, you know, there's a variety of types of advertising in podcasts. So you've got your live reads and pre-recorded, and then just pre-produced, you run it somewhere in there. The client came up with it. No big deal. Mm-hmm. Is there a preference that you have for what you want to have in your content?
Yeah. I mean, will you restate that?
Well, question? I guess it's more, I should backtrack. So because what you're doing is so very specific and you don't have to take every single client that comes through, I'm guessing you'd likely be strategic over what types of companies are the best fit for the content. And then at that point, you know, looking at like, would you do lives knowing that at that point you're essentially endorsing that company, or do you prefer more separation of church and state where it's, you know, a pre-produced spot that you can just run into content and therefore it's not your personal endorsement that's attached to this.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, we kind of decide on a case by case basis. I mean, there's definitely like categories of ads that we don't take, like oil company ads are a really obvious one. But otherwise it's sort of, you know, if a company asks for personal endorsement, then I will just sort of look into the company a bit, because actually, I mean, we had this experience too, where I was doing ads for like a hair color company. And I got an email about it from a listener that was like, I can't believe that, you know, as someone who focuses on like corporate malfeasance and disinformation, that you would, you know, hawk a product that has like a bunch of chemicals in it. So I was like, oh, I mean, that's maybe a fair statement, you know, but it's, we try to balance it with like, well, you know,
we got to pay the bills.
Right. Can't eat ethics. No, I'm just kidding. but yeah. So again, it's like, because of the way that our kind of business model is structured, it does let us say no to things if we feel really uncomfortable with them. I mean, we have been talking to a couple of companies about being sort of, you know, lead sponsors or exclusive sponsors. And in those situations too, I just am being very, very upfront about like, this does not mean that, you know, we're going to cover something that you want us to cover or, you know,
yeah, because you've got to have a really clear line of church and state.
Yeah,
what you do. No question.
Yeah.
So, Amy, I know we're coming to the end of our time. I need to read you a quote. And if it is, in fact, accurate, I'd love for you to elaborate. And the quote is, podcasting is quickly becoming the new Facebook as far as disinformation is concerned.
Yes, that is very true. Is that me? Are you quoting
That's
me to
you.
Me?
I'm quoting you to you. But based on our introduction to this conversation, I want to make sure I'm fact checking before I attribute.
Yes, it's me. And I absolutely think that that's true. It is a, I think actually potentially a huge problem, and it's kind of just being ignored right now. So just to give you some background on that, there started to be more and more oil company ads in podcasts, I started getting people emailing me asking why they were hearing stuff in podcasts that like they had never heard on, you know, radio ads or TV, because a lot of the ads were really kind of overstating things like the potential for carbon capture or how much Exxon is invested in algae biofuels or things like that. And I thought, oh, that's, yeah, good question. I don't know why. And so I started looking into it, and I realized that podcasts are governed by the same rules that govern social media. Which is effectively no rules when it comes to accuracy or like anything like it. So yeah. And the one that really got me was, and a lot of the NPR podcasts had these ads in them too. And that seemed really strange because they have such a strict policy around what they will put in, you know, kind of underwriting ads on broadcast. And so I asked them.
No idea. I mean, you've uncovered like PBS, New York,
yes,
places you would not expect have been, you know, on the take with this for a long time.
Yeah. And so when I asked the NPR folks, like, how come you're allowing this in your podcast, but like you would never allow this on your website or in broadcast? And they said, oh, well, I mean, because there's no rules about it in podcasts. And I was like, guys, like, you're public media. It's not illegal, is not an ethics policy. Like, what are you doing? So, you know, you can imagine if public media has that take, how everybody else is handling it. Yeah. But I think, I mean, the other layer to that is that, like, you know, I've been very surprised at how few shows actually have fact checkers on like even really investigative pieces. And I think we all saw the fallout of that with the Caliphate scandal last year, you know, where it's like, oh, this, the entire story of this podcast is false. And like, either nobody caught it or nobody checked or whatever. But like, if you're going to do a nonfiction podcast, then I would think that you would want to get your facts straight, you know? And like, I mean, and I see this even on, you know, like, I don't know. I was listening to the show The Dream in the second season, and they had an episode on phthalates in beauty products. And, you know, it was kind of taking the stance of, you know, oh, like all these crazy wellness gurus are trying to scare people about the chemicals in their beauty products, and it's totally overblown and this and that and the other. And I heard the host say something that I've heard like every chemical lobbyist say for years, which is, I mean, too much water can be bad for you if you drink too much of it. And I just was like, oh God, like there's just a level of, I don't know, like reporting and expertise that I think you need to talk about things like, you know, whether or not products are safe, you know, or what impact a chemical has on human health or whatever. And it's like, I think it's very concerning kind of how fast and easy podcasting has been with facts for a long time.
Well, look, I know you got to go, but one thing I just want to tell you to encourage you is that, we haven't solved the thing, but I will tell you the work we're doing in tandem with this show, we are taking steps. So, for example, we partnered with Ad Fontes Media, who makes the media bias chart. Mm-hmm. And I know that.
Oh, interesting.
And we got them. We partnered with them to launch the podcast media bias chart. So now
that
actually exists. Yeah. And we've got hundreds of shows on there. And like, look, is it perfect? No. Is it a bit of a Rorschach for everyone that looks at it? Yes. Mm-hmm, but let me tell you, it's a start. And I think, you know, we like the work Kristen and the team do, you know, through our firm, are using that information in the planning process so that clients can balance their business objectives with their like brand values that they're stating. And we're trying to help connect the dots so they can actually market in accordance with that. So I think that there's change happening. We're trying to be part of that change. And, you know, it's been really helpful to have you come share with us everything that you're doing. Last question for you. What are you working on next? And how can people follow you or get involved?
Yeah.
Depending on their interest.
Yeah. So we have Rigged launching in late October. And then we have a show that's following all of the different climate law cases, litigation, I guess, which I know sounds really boring. But my whole thinking on that is that, like, I'm like a huge law nerd. And I think that every lawsuit has an interesting story behind it, because people don't generally file big lawsuits before they kind of get to the end of their rope, because it's expensive and a pain in the ass to file a lawsuit. So we're getting into some of the stories behind the now nearly 200 climate lawsuits that are active all over the world. And that show's coming in late November, and it's called Damages. And then I'm currently co-hosting the new season of Scene on Radio, which is a history and like kind of documentary style show out of the Duke University School for Documentary Studies.
That's so cool.
That's cool. I know. I love that show. And then in January, I'm going to take a big old break.
Yeah, you've earned it. I think you, I hope it's a long break, and I hope that you get to relax and slow down. It's really impressive, everything you're doing, and I'm glad to get to know you. I think this is something we're going to be able to share with others in the marketing community, and
awesome.
We appreciate the work that you're doing. So thank
you. Awesome. Thank you. Same. I'm excited to check out the podcast
Media Bias chart.
Yeah, indeed. That's awesome.
Indeed. Yeah, there's a free sample online at
Bias
Media. Yeah. Okay, and thank you, Kristen, for sitting in with us. That was fun.
Yeah, no, it was definitely fascinating. I had a lot of questions at the part that I wasn't supposed to be participating in. I'm like, damn it. So
that's okay. This show is dedicated to advancing our mission of mobilizing marketers to promote truth and civility in journalism. We value clarity, truth, fairness, respect, de-escalation, and tolerance, and we invite you to engage with us at MediaRoundtable.com. Now, if you found the show helpful, you're committed to our cause, please follow us on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you like to listen. It's always free. And if you're a marketer looking for support to live this stuff out, you can get in touch with our ad agency, Oxford Road, by visiting oxfordroad.com and subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Influencer. Special thanks to Bianca, Kyle, Jennifer, of course, Kristen, and the team at Podcast One. And as always, influence responsibly.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.